There are those who say that life is an illusion, and that reality is simply a figment of the imagination.
Look who the birds have brought us this week. Welcome, and congratulations for crossing the threshold of realities. There's much to share if you know the language of the birds. Welcome back, one and all. We have a special treat for you today. So gather around the fire on this side of the veil, and we'll start having a sharing of stories by way of our guest, who is a musician, a world bridger, spiritual warrior, and brujero extraordinaire, all packaged in one vessel, who goes by the name of Oz. Welcome to the God Box Cafe, Oz.
Well, thank you for having me, Yvonne. Love your show.
Let's start with a scenario.
Sure.
A young man steps up to your door. He is soaking wet because it's been pouring rain and only pussies use umbrellas. So he knocks on your door and he says to you, "I have come a long way to find you. I have had a dream. I was a stockbroker in New York, and I had a sudden crisis of identity. So I have walked away from my job. I have come to understand that I need to change what I consider important and walk a different path. And I have found my way to you because I believe that maybe the shamanic road is the one that I should be walking." What is the first thing you say to him?
First thing I tell him is that somebody that doesn't know how to get out of the rain may not be suitable for shamanism. I would definitely understand that somebody in this situation, because many people are always looking for something significant or something meaningful. The West is at this time feeling quite lost. But the motivation to move toward shamanism isn't a natural one, essentially. I would be surprised why this individual hasn't chosen religion instead. To decide shamanism over religion or some other form of belief, you know, that has to be brought into question. So you can't just start with like, "Yeah, come on in, let's teach you some shamanism," right? That's a very bad way to go. I would definitely want to know what made him make this decision or come into this direction. And he has to know that shamanism is a lifelong study, that there's a lot of things that are involved, and that it will try to break you long before you're ready to be received, as many are called and very few are chosen.
That being said, when did you receive the calling, and how did you know that this was the path that you were destined to walk?
Well, that's not exactly how my path started. My path started very much like the seeker in your story. You know, there was some dissatisfaction and a yearning that led me to seek. The way of seekers is that you don't necessarily know even what it is you're seeking. So you knock on lots of doors, you read lots of books, you study lots of things, and you get some things right, you get a lot of things wrong. And if you're paying attention and you're sincere in your pursuit, the path becomes more and more clear. So for me, going into that path wasn't something that I was very knowledgeable at the very beginning. I was practicing shamanism long before I even knew that the word shamanism existed. But I spent 7 years in the practice and realized very early that I was not mature enough. I was not spiritually mature enough. I wasn't stable enough to participate in the shamanic path. So I abandoned it. But I had learned enough in 7 years to carry me through the next 14, 15 years. I had learned enough from the practice to be able to teach and to give good counsel. And it wasn't until much later, 15, 16 years later, that I was called back in. And then I didn't want to. I definitely did not want to go back in. I understood then the craziness and the destabilizing nature of shamanism. And I didn't want my life to be torn into little bits and pieces. And so I rejected it. I'm sure you've heard of shamanic sickness. And that's what ended up happening. The only way out was in. That's where you get into the phrase, physician, heal thyself. So if my practices, my understandings, and my principles were correct, now I had to use them to make myself better. And it was a very challenging time. And again, I rejected and resisted the entire way. But inevitably, I accepted it. I had to. And that's when the healing really begins. But I'm not a person that believes in the healing journey. Our path is always about getting things done. So we don't go on a healing journey because healing journeys go on forever. We're looking about arriving at a cure. And so shamanism became a cure for consciousness, a cure for like the ails of consciousness, emotional cure, physical cure, spiritual cure.
You originally hail from South America. Would the fact that you were raised within that culture have had some influence on your understanding of that path and your exposure to those teachings?
I would say that being born in South America and being raised in a culture that, unlike the West, brujas, which is witches, brujos, curanderos, those are healers, hierberos, which are herbalists, is very much part of the common language. So for us, witches, warlocks, and healers, and psychics, that's just commonplace. You can just walk down your street, you know, half a block, and there's a woman there that prays to the saints, and she can do healing. She can cure headaches. That's her thing. She's a headache specialist. And then, you know, half a block down, there's a woman that just has a knack for making relationships work out. And there's different men who are good for counsel and teach you how to get a girl or how to fix a relationship or all kinds of different things. There's specialists in every area. So yes, our culture, because it is embedded in the average language and it's not unfamiliar, it's a very Catholic. You know, I was raised Catholic. And despite that, every family has their own saint. They have a saint that the guardian or the patron of their house or the patron of their family. So that's very shamanistic. You're talking about these little deities and gods and spirits and angels. It's part of the parlance. So yeah, because that's there, there's a tendency to have, say, a wider perspective on it. But I wouldn't say that because that was in the background, that contributed in any significant way. On the contrary, it was the Catholic embedding, the dogma that led me in the opposite direction.
Very often people stumble upon this journey of identity, for want of a better description, as far as seeking from a spiritual standpoint. And if the religion has in some way disappointed them, then quite often they explore in other directions. And this tends to be one of the possibilities that people who may be curious would look to as a solution for whatever the disappointment was where the organized religion part of the spectrum was concerned. But would you consider this something that is even comparable, or is this something entirely other? The idea here of it replacing a religious belief in some people's minds, would that perhaps be inaccurate with respect to what you would consider this way of walking through the world?
I would say that shamanism is anti-religion. In fact, shamanism is so far outside of the realm of religion, you can't even consider it a belief structure. Only the West takes shamanism and tries to turn it into a religion. The truth of shamanism is if you strip the world of all religion and all belief systems, what will remain is shamanism. Shamanism is inherent to human nature. It begins there. It arises from the earth. And if you were to strike every book off the shelf and burn them all in a big pile and destroy every edifice to some philosophical foundation or belief, what would rise from the ashes would be shamanism. 100% of the time, it would rise up again and again. You can never destroy shamanism because it is embedded inside the soul of every human being. When you wipe out everything, when you remove all that has been placed and indoctrinated and established in one form or another, what will remain will always be shamanism. And I'm not just saying this because, you know, as a practitioner, I have something to in my ball court to say, you know, because I believe it has to be so. I'm telling you this because it is very easy archaeologically, historically, to look through the records of all the world cultures, and you will see consistently that shamanism is the first religion. It is always the first religion. And that religion can develop and grow, and it will be called Wicca. It'll get a name, and it'll become organized, and it'll be called Wicca. But underneath, it's shamanism. Originally, it's shamanism, or it's druidry, right? The practice of the druids, or it may be Macumba or Condomble or it could be any number of different perspectives, and they all arise from the same foundation. This is why if you go from any part of the world to any other part of the world, you will always spot the shaman. Now, I was just saying to a friend earlier how it's really easy to spot the shaman in any group, in any crowd, in any country. Just look for the craziest hat. Right? You just look for the craziest hat, and the crazy hat will tell you either, A, that's the chief, but if the hat is crazier, that's the shaman. That's the shaman or the healer. So that's going to be your doctor 100% of the time. There is no school for shamanism. The West is trying to do something in this fashion, and that's a horribly dangerous mistake. Okay, it's a very dangerous mistake. The shaman is a natural healer. They observe the world. They observe the nature of themselves. It's an epistemological process. It's an entirely epistemological process of self-inquiry. It's through a direct observation. Any man and woman, any person, anywhere in the world who takes the time to observe nature, observe their nature and the nature of the living things around them, will arrive at the same thing. They will be at the same school. And this is why 100% of the time, and I've had many encounters with various shamans and healers from different parts of the world, and our teachings are exactly identical. When you remove the beliefs from the surface, what is underneath, the principles are always 100% identical, because we went to the same school. We all went to the same college, the University of Life. So one of us cannot know more than the other, but we have our different techniques and methods we have established through our practice. There's knowers of various things. Some are better herbalists, some are better psychologists, some are better storytellers. And they're going to be different, but that's where they differ. And that's the only place that they differ.
I have spoken to some people while conducting my own research on this path, and I've had several of them indicate to me with respect to the source of the word shaman. And some of them have argued that there are those who are misappropriating this term and those who cannot carry this term because they are not born into that specific region where the source of that word even originated. What is your perspective on that?
Well, we're living in a time when you're dealing with a lot of politics on words, language, and I have a very strong stance on the freedom of speech. Because when you start to control somebody's language, you're controlling their thoughts. And I find that to be extremely dangerous. And it is a time-tested, it's a very predictable method that has been used by any invasion group into another group. The first thing that group does, whatever the conquering group does, the first thing that they do is they remove those people's ability to speak their language. They infect them with a new language, a new set of rules, and that changes the way they think. So everybody's arguing about shamanism and the word shamanism and who can use it and who's not allowed to use it. And I assure you, it is strictly a Western perspective. There is not anywhere in the Amazon or in the plains of the steppes or in China or in the Amazon or in Africa where people are saying, oh, this person isn't a shaman or this person can be a shaman or they're not from this line or not from that line. That is strictly Western. That is a strictly Western concept. In the Amazon, a shaman is a shaman. They say that they're a shaman, they're a shaman. And you can go and see them. And if they're good at what they do, you might go see them again. And if they suck, that's the end of it. So if that person sucks and they have no clients, that's the end of their shamanism. It just ends itself. So while a lot of people are worried about the misappropriation of terms or people are trying to take terms, that is a Western phenomenon. A little bit of history about shamanism, okay? And that's that shamanism is actually called Tengriism. It comes from the god Tengri or Tengra. That's the sky god. And this is all part of the Central Asiatic region. So you're talking about Siberia, Mongol, Turkish, part of the Chinese. Tibet's part of that too. It was a one naturally developing philosophical foundation of life, right? And that's shamanism proper. It's the Siberians that gave it the name shamanism. And it was, I can't remember the name of the anthropologist who came back with the word shaman. But in South America, it's chaman. So it's not dissimilar in many ways. But a person would just call them a healer, a curandero, or yerbero. In Spanish, at least, these terms are more specifically suited to a particular kind of spirit doctor or herbalist. And it gets quite complicated, right? Because some herbalists don't just work with herbs. They also work with prayers. You got some that only work with prayers. You got some that only work with perfumes. You got some that work with various kinds of medicines. Some of those medicines are psychedelic and very, very powerful. There's a huge difference between what we call medicines in South America and what the natives here call medicines. Like our people, when they talk about medicine, you can be absolutely certain that you're going to experience a very profound life-altering effect. They're going to be quite different. The Tibetans have their original shamanic religion. It's called Bon. You know, I mentioned Tengger, and the other one is the name of, so that's the sky god, that's Tengger. And then Gazar, or Ije, is the earth. And this is just pure observation. If you were just standing in the field and you looked up, you'd say, well, that's the sky, you know, that's everything above me. And then the earth is everything below you. And you could give them names, but the connection to these two things, right? Vastness and spaciousness and material concreteness, solidity and abundance. And you could build an entire philosophy of understanding from these two things, which is what happens. So I'm not too big on what a person calls themselves. I don't think that really matters. That's a very Western construct, and it does not belong in the realm of shamanism. Shamans don't care what people call them. They don't care what they call themselves. They know what they have to offer, and you can take it or leave it.
Let's delve a little more into the usage of entheogenics with respect to how one bridges worlds, achieves altered states, and retrieves information in an effort to provide the necessary service to the community. I've spoken to several people who've gone on ayahuasca trips and have traveled to Peru to do so. And the experience itself, while they were within the confines of that environment, was profound. But I have found a lot of people subsequent to that struggling desperately to integrate that information and then try to get on with their lives within the context of the same social norms. So they've gone exploring, they've expanded their perception, but then they don't know what to do with that when it comes to adjusting to the world that they live in on a daily basis. What are your recommendations as far as the follow-up to these types of experiences?
Well, that's a very big question. There's lots of components, lots of parts in that question. So you have to understand that shamanism has many functions. We're talking a properly trained shaman, okay? A properly trained shaman, it's a multidisciplinary system of knowledge. There's a lot of things that you have to know. In the West, people think that they can take a weekend course and come out the other end as a shaman. And I'm all for it because I'd rather have more crazy, you know, half-assed shamans than a bunch of religious book bangers. I'd rather see more shamans in the world because at least they're on a path of personal self-discovery. Shamanism has many tools. And a good shaman is a good listener, a good psychologist. There's somebody who has experienced a lot and will say very little. And they give the person the means and the tools to be able to make corrections in their own life at whatever level. But in shamanism, when somebody comes to see you, you don't automatically, this is Western, right? The Western shaman's like, oh, you've got spirits. You're covered in demons. It's the automatic thing to go to. But a proper shaman listens, takes in all the details, listens to the story very carefully, and then makes an assessment. What is physically new? What is physically going on? What kind of work are you doing? What kind of stressors are there? What kind of mental and emotional and then spiritual stressors and problems have arisen? And then collecting all of that data, they can make an assessment on what that person actually needs. And sometimes that person just needs to get away from somebody in their life that is not conductive, or they need to change their job, or they need to change some particular behavior. A person could have an allergy that the shaman detects quite quickly that the person's unaware of that could be changing all of this behavior, making them think that they're possessed, or whatever the person imagines that is going on. An intelligent shaman doesn't go, oh, you've got a rash, it's demons. Oh, you've got a skin allergy. It must be a spell. We're going to uncurse you. That's just absolutely absurd. That is not the practice of shamanism. Practice of shamanism has a lot of experience, and it takes a lot of research and a lot of know-how. And so you take each case one at a time, and you gather up the information very carefully. You assess each thing very carefully. And you also have to understand that there's a psychology that the person is bringing to the table. That requires a particular kind of cure, we'll call it. So sometimes the cure is going to be very materialistic, very basic. It might be an herb, a simple medicine. It would be like, hey, you know what? You need to drink some chamomile tea for the next couple of days. Or it could be, maybe you should lay off coffee, or maybe you should quit drinking, or it could be a number of things. Something very simple, a very simple medicine. Now, in certain situations, you need medicines that are going to be a little bit stronger. Now, I can tell you right now that herbs are not going to help somebody who is psychologically bent on their own obsession with their idea that they are possessed or that they've been cursed by somebody. For that, the shaman has to create a ritual. And that ritual needs to be convoluted. It needs to be scary as hell. It needs to be intensive. And it needs to be expensive, because that's the only way it's going to work. If that person really believes that they are cursed or they are spelled in some fashion, then the ritual has to meet that thing on the same level, which is to say, what you're doing is you're creating a psychodrama. Good shamans build rituals. Rituals make connections between the conscious and the unconscious mind of the person. It connects the person to the event in their life. That's the reason that the psychodrama is there. We cannot live without ritual. We're in the 21st century. Every shaman has a cell phone, but magic is still very real, and we can't live without it. We still have birthday parties. We still celebrate Christmas. There's all manner of rituals that we have to do. Now, in a case where a person is dealing with something much, much deeper, and it might be something deeply psychological, where it could be something deeply emotional or something that was traumatically ingrained in them from an early age, or maybe very recently, there are medicines that can help that person get through. And some of these medicines, like I said, are at the level of herbs that don't have any psychotropic effects. But in the case where it's something deep and it's something really profound and there's no other way to make contact with it, that is when those medicines are used. Those medicines do not have, for the most part, they don't have any real physiological effects in the way that, say, an aspirin or a Tylenol would. They generally just affect consciousness. They affect the mental state of the person. And by engaging with those particular medicines, they can dislodge you from your regular way of thinking and give your mind and brain an opportunity to recalibrate. Now, obviously, the reason people go to Peru is because a lot of these things are illegal here in Canada. That's all starting to change, and it's going to take some time. People need to be very responsible so that they don't continuously remain illegal. But until that time happens, you're going to still have to go to Peru or some other part of the world to engage in these medicines. The people that work with these medicines know the dose, they know the safe limits, but there's still a lot of danger. You know, there are shamans that are pretty shady, and we can talk about that as well. But the medicine does the work. Here, the shaman wants to take the credit. All shamans here want to be the, oh, I'm the power. That's the origin and source of the power. The shamans in South America and in other parts of the world who use those medicines do not claim to have the power. They are simply the carriers and makers of the medicine. It is the medicine that does the work. But it is the person, the client, who must do the working. So if the client is not willing or understanding what they're there to do, the medicine will not assist them. And yes, as you said earlier, they will have a very difficult time reintegrating into society. They've just been expanded. They're going to have an entirely different view. But I can't tell you how often it happens that a man or a woman or a person goes to Peru, has an ayahuasca experience, and comes back, and they're going to be a shaman now. They've seen the calling. They've seen the light. They know what their purpose is. And to that, I can tell you this as a practitioner of this knowledge, is that the plants are alive. Plants are intelligent, and they don't care about people. They use people like they use ants and bees and insects to pollinate. So ayahuasca doesn't care about you. It'll help you if you've come for the help and you're ready to do the work. It wants to propagate itself. So if it infects you with that knowledge and it makes you think you should be a shaman, you're just guaranteeing that you're going to plant that plant, you're going to harvest that plant, you're going to look after that plant, you're going to carry that plant, you're going to move from one part of the world to another. You're no different than a bee as far as that plant is concerned. And so it doesn't surprise me one bit that anybody going into one of these ceremonies is going to come back and want to be a shaman. But as I said to you earlier, many are called and few are chosen. You need a lot of knowledge, you need a lot of understanding, and you have to be very aware that these plants have an agenda. And just to make this clear for you and your listeners, you know, when we watch a bee go to a flower, we think, oh, look at that poor bee. Like, what a sucker, right? It's being put to work. It doesn't even know it. It's the flower. The flower has made itself attractive to the bee. It gives the bee a little something sweet, right? It gives it a little bit of taste of some otherworldly substance and a gorgeous fragrance. And the bee goes in and gets what it wants and doesn't realize it's been used by the flower to carry pollen to another flower to continue the propagation. Tell me how this is different from corn. Corn grows and man goes, I need to collect this. And then it grows a little bit bigger and man harvests the best grains to grow bigger corn. And the plant starts to figure this out. And what does man do? He will burn an entire acre of forest to make way for one plant. That plant knows exactly what it's doing. It is using man in order to propagate itself. They are super intelligent. They know exactly what they're doing. They 100% understand what they're doing. So if it can take a Westerner, if I was at the ayahuasca plant, what would I do? Well, we got some gringos coming. All right, really give them a light show. Turn them into shamans. They will carry us into their part of the world. They're going to grow and plant us. Ayahuasca vine, the chacruna plant, and the linye have made their way to California. It's growing in Hawaii. It is growing all over the world. People are growing in greenhouses. This plant's smart. It knows how to get itself onto an airplane and across the other side of the world and get itself planted and cultivated. And that plant gets the best light, best water, best fertilizer. It is being worshipped as a god. Are you kidding me? That is just genius. And man thinks that they're the clever ones. They're just little bees to the intelligence of these plants. When I talked to the plants, they told me they were here when we were first learning to walk. We were first learning to crawl. They showed me with all certainty that they've got everything under control. And they know exactly what they're doing. All world history is all in plants. Plants are world history. The spice trade, sugar plantations, sugar trade, tea, coffee. Look at coffee. Coffee's brilliant. It's got you like hooked. You're going to burn this forest down to grow a plantation of coffee. Chocolate, vanilla, cinnamon. These plants got you guys, man. They got you. They know they got you. You're hooked. And they're going to use you to propagate themselves in order to continue their existence. We're part of the system. They can help us. They can heal us. But make no mistake about it, they will never think twice about piggybacking off of what you do in order to advance their agenda, which is to survive. And they've managed to do that for millions of years. They're very, very smart.
Out of the number of choices one could make to arrive at these altered states within the plant kingdom, you emphasized ayahuasca, but there are also alternatives like peyote and mushrooms. And so how would one approach which to choose?
That's an excellent question. A good shaman knows which medicine is going to be best suited for a particular situation. So there are many, and some of them are not as powerful as ayahuasca. And yeah, you did mention some of them like peyote. There's iboga as well. That's from Africa. You've got the DMT, the frog, el sapo. There's a sapito sapo. And there's, there's two sapos, right? There's two frog medicines. So cambo is the one that is burned into your skin. It's very toxic. And it goes onto your skin and it causes your body to flush. It can be very powerful. And then there's the other sapo, which is used, you smoke it. It's the glands of the cane toad. The material is squirted from these glands on its back onto a piece of glass that's scraped, and then it's smoked. It's a very, very strong psychedelic. It's 5-MeO-DMT. Of course, ayahuasca, its active ingredients are also DMT. But there are others. There's lots of other medicines. A very simple medicine is something like one made from mapacho. Mapacho is South American tobacco. So there's tobacco that's grown in Canada is called tobacum nicotina. And it's not as strong as tobacum rustica, which grows in South America. Much stronger amounts of various compounds and components, such as harmaline, and it has some DMT in it as well. It's a snuff, and it's called a jape or rape. It's just a snuff that can be blown into your nose. It lasts for about 5 to 10 minutes, and it can be extremely insightful and very, very powerful. And that's a medicine that is used for heart. So if you're really upset and you're going through some things that are maybe a bit distressed, you're really angry, you're really frustrated, you're really hurt, the shaman might use a little bit of jape. Again, it just takes a few seconds. It's blown into the nostrils through a tube called a tepi, or you can self-administer with a V-shaped tube or a U-shaped tube, usually made out of bone, that you can self-administer. And again, that's a very short-lived medicine, but very powerful, very insightful, and it can be life-transforming. But it's knowing the right medicine. So if you use Western terms, it's much easier to understand. If you have a headache, you grab for an aspirin, or you maybe grab for a Tylenol. if you've got a sore throat, maybe you'll take some cough medicine. But it's not one medicine for everything. If somebody has a headache, you don't give them anesthetic. You don't put them out. The problem with the way the West works is that they think that I have this emotional trauma to deal with, so ayahuasca is the solution. I'm unhappy in my relationship, so it's ayahuasca. And that's not the way it works. A proper shaman doesn't say, okay, yeah, it's one medicine for everything that ails you, because that's just not how it works. And like I said, not all of the medicines are psychedelic. And we were talking also about the fact that shamanism uses a lot of different modalities to change state of consciousness. And that's a very important thing, something that I've been talking about for years. And I said that by the time most people, and this was back when I was about 18, 19, I was talking about this then. I said that by the time most people in that room are 30 or 40 years old, they will have discovered that there is a fifth dynamic. Humans have five dynamics that are important to life, right? We need to eat, we need to drink, we need human contact, food, water, drink, and human contact. But I suggested that the fifth dynamic hasn't been discovered, and there is a fifth dynamic, and that is the need for human beings to be able to alter their consciousness. And you can see evidence of this in a five-year-old kid that learns to spin in a spot. The reason they spin in a spot is because it makes them dizzy. It changes their consciousness. We change our consciousness through music. We change our consciousness through drinking coffee, smoking cigarettes, drinking alcohol, laughing hysterically, smoking pot, or maybe running or heavy breathing. There's a thousand different ways that humans change their consciousness. And we need to be able to do that, because without being able to shift our consciousness, we are prisoners in our own minds and bodies. So shamanism doesn't just use psychedelics or psychoactive components to change consciousness. You can use drumming. You can use ecstatic dance, rhythmic breathing. There are hundreds of different ways, including sexual practices such as Tantra. There are many different methods and modalities that will shift consciousness and give you access to a particular platform. Each platform has inherently, by its nature, a certain amount of data, knowledge, or information that can be retrieved. So a shaman needs to be able to retrieve that information. We are going to the source to retrieve the data. And if that data is valid and it is true, it can be tested. Again, at this point, I would say that there's a difference, right? So if there are shamans in your audience today, they have beliefs. I promise you that you will know it's a belief and it is incoherent and it is probably not true. You will have to defend it. If something is true, it is indefensible. What I mean by indefensible is it doesn't need to be defended. You never have to fight for it because it's self-proclaiming. The earth is its witness. It can be seen. It can be experienced. It can be found directly. If it's a belief, you're always at its mercy. When a person believes something, what you get for that belief, you have to pay. You have to give back in terms of defending that belief. And so a shaman, a proper shaman, is not a believer. They are a knower. It's a Gnostic approach. It's a direct approach of understanding. So when we're talking about medicines, the shaman himself or herself has gone into these things and healed themselves. Knowing how they healed, they know what medicines work, what amount and how much, and who you would prescribe it to, who you should prescribe it to. There are some people that you would never give them mushrooms. Their minds are not stable. Their emotions are not stable. They would enter a world of such unimaginable contrast to their ordinary reality that they would not be able to recover from. They would come back more traumatized than they went in. Some people, it's going to be peyote. You're going to be sitting all night. You're going to be singing all night. You're not going to be moving. You're going to be in one spot and you're going to be doing this work. You need a roadman that can take you there. Somebody who understands how that medicine works. You don't just go to somebody who thinks, oh, you know, we've got some peyote. I'm a shaman. We're just going to eat this and listen to some music and we're going to figure it out. It's like, you can do that. And it will figure you out, but you won't figure anything out. It's about going to somebody who understands how those medicines work. Not every medicine is good for everything. There are, for example, medicines that are more for the emotions. There are some that are more for mental stuff. Some of them are more for physical stuff. Some of them are for deep trauma. Some of them are just to give you some insight. But there's lots of medicines. Mushroom, even cannabis can be a great teacher, but it's not for everybody. For some people, the word dope sums it up pretty good. You're not learning nothing. You're just becoming dumber. She'll offer that to you. You want to forget? You want to turn into a couch potato? You want your ass macromated into that couch? Here you go. She'll give you that. But in the hands of somebody who's done the work or is doing the work, again, don't take my word for it. Do your own research. And there's a reason it's called ganja. It's called Ganja because it comes from the Ganges River. And you know who used it? The gurus. Gurus were like big puffers, big smokers of pot, massively strong stuff, indica variety. And they smoked them through these things called chillums. The chillum is a type of pipe, the type of clay pipe. And we still have the word chilling out, right? You're chilling out with your chillum, right? You're smoking some ganja. But that plant can deliver an incredible amount of insight to somebody who's on a spiritual path, who's working through some things, and you want to test the strength and validity of your ego. That plant will show you, no question about it. No question about it. But it's used for prayer and connection. It's still being used today by the followers of Selassie, Haile Selassie, which what are they called now? Rastafarians. It's an herb that's spoken of in the Bible, a fruit-bearing herb. So to partake of fruit-bearing herbs, that's one of them. So it's perfectly legit, and you can use it to connect with God. It's a time for prayer. That's not what people use it for today, but it's there. So yeah, different medicines have different properties, different purposes, and you have to find the right medicine for what's going on. A good shaman will look you up and down, talk to you for a good period of time, inquire, do some work on your behalf in their own time, and then conclude from what they know, whether or not they should even subscribe or prescribe a medicine. Again, here you can't do that because the control has to be in those people who have PhDs and so on. But before those PhDs were around, it was the knowers, right? In fact, that's what shamanism means. It means to know, right? To be a knower. And another wise guy, one of the wise women, right? It's to know.
Let's put ourselves for a moment in the position of an individual who isn't ready to commit to walking this path, but is in a situation where they have reached a point of confusion and needs assistance. How would you define a shaman who is legitimate versus someone who is going to take advantage of a person's vulnerability and sell them snake oil?
I love this question. All shamans are legitimate, even the charlatans. All shamans are legitimate, even the charlatans, even the snake oil salesmen. I would fill the world full of these men and women. And the reason why is that if you take a charlatan who's selling snake oil, okay, and there are many of these, sooner or later, they will make that snake oil the wrong way and somebody will get sick. And if somebody dies at their hands, it will correct them. It will correct their behavior. It will correct their beliefs and it will correct their understanding. That is why the shamanic path always reveals the truth 100% of the time. I say, let these idiots have their weekend workshops where they teach people to become a shaman for $1,000 in a couple of hours over, you know, two or three nights. The person who is seeking, a true seeker, will go because they don't know any better. They'll get duped. They'll have their money taken. They won't learn anything, but they will discover. They will discover what is true from what is false through direct experiencing. That is the nature of life. That is why this is ground up. The snake oil salesman will continue to sell snake oil. And at some point, there's enough people that have had the snake oil to know that it does nothing and they'll be out of business. If they want to stay in business, they're going to have to find a snake oil that actually does something, that somebody benefits from, at which point they've become real, haven't they? You see, what I'm trying to tell you is, if you were to say to me, you know, I'm a carpenter, but you've never worked with wood your entire life, okay? But you go into a workshop and you try to build something every day, having no idea what you're doing while making the massive claim that you're the best wood architect that has ever lived. If you go in every day and you come out with something that doesn't work, it looks like crap, it's put together wrong and falls apart, but you're still claiming that you're this incredibly well-gifted carpenter, I can assure you that if you go in every day and you build stuff and it doesn't work and you hurt your fingers and you bash your thumb, your joints come undone and so on and so forth, sooner or later, the very act of practicing will correct you. It is not possible for you to claim that you are a carpenter going in and out of a shop every day for 6 months and not coming out 6 months later, somebody who can actually build things out of wood. It's just a fact. So here's what I'm saying. You take somebody who has studied with somebody who is not a shaman for even a year. Before the end of that year, they will know that that person is not true. You will be able to test directly what works from what doesn't work. So I say all the power to it. Shamanism is very strongly connected to the cosmic clown, the cosmic fool, coyote, the liar, the trickster, and the devil. because it's all medicine. That's what it does. You never know with a shaman whether they're being the trickster or whether they're being the healer. It's on you. That's what brings you into awareness. That's what brings you into focus. Are you going to place your safety and your well-being in somebody's hands that you don't know? You do that here in the West. You go to the doctor says, oh, you got this wrong. And you let them open you up and take part of your guts out. And you just take that they know what they're doing. You assume that all the doctors that graduate from school are at the same level. But they're not. They're just people. They're just people. You're going to have doctors that are really good at their craft. And you're going to have doctors that if they were in the same room with other professional doctors, they're going to look at this person and say, how did you ever get your license? This guy is so completely incompetent and inept. It's no different in the shamanic world. I have met medicine men and shamans and healers of various kinds. And while they may suck at one area or another, somebody benefits from what they do. And I would not have the world not have that person there. And I can assure you, if the snake oil does nothing, right? It's just a vegetable oil in a jar. It's not going to do any harm. It's perfectly safe. But it has a very powerful placebo effect. Maybe it doesn't work on most people because there's no active ingredient. But there are two people or three people out of 10 that swear by it. Look at my hair. It's grown thicker because of this snake oil. Look at my love life. You know, I can go longer and better because of this snake oil. My boobs are gotten bigger. I've made more money because of this snake oil. And they benefit from it just because they believe. No harm is being done and everything's all right. The most people will lose is some time and a little bit of money. And they're going to learn a very big lesson. And that's going to teach them to be smarter and wiser and more careful. There needs to be charlatans amongst the real shamans. Because if you didn't do this, every shaman would have a lineup all the way down the block of fools. You have nothing but a block, a mile long of a convoy of idiots coming to see you who don't need what you have to offer. So the charlatans, what they do is they weed this out. And if that fool decides or discovers that they actually are in need, they will find it because that is the way it works. That is the law and the energetics that governs the healer and the person being healed. They will always find each other, but the journey to get there will prepare you. It will always prepare you. Now, I do understand, of course, as I mentioned earlier, that there are some pretty twisted shamans. A lot of that has to do with the Westerners going into Peru because they want to have an ayahuasca experience. So, you know, ayahuasca is not complicated to put together. It's only two plants. It's not rare. It grows reasonably common. So anybody can learn to put this together and call themselves a shaman. And you make $12 a month normally, and now you can make $500 a head. You only have to have five people show up. You give them this drink and you're set up, man. You're put together. You've got a life. You've gone from the ground up very quickly. But there are some shady people, most certainly. Most certainly there are shady people, but there are shady surgeons here in the West as well. It's the same everywhere. You take your chances when you put your mind, your heart, your emotions, and your spirit in someone else's hands. It's life, man. It's just the way it is. You're going to play with wolves. If you're not a wolf, you can't run with them. They're going to eat you. It's just the way it goes. So I'm not opposed to the charlatan. I'm not opposed to the liar and the fool. They will teach you. They will teach you to become wise. If you spent your time going from one idiot to another teaching you false shamanism, by the time you come out the other end, you will be a true and legitimate shaman, 100%, because you will know what is not true. You will know what is phony. You will know what is not ethically correct. They will have corrected you. Do you understand what I'm saying by that?
Absolutely. Let's take a step sideways and add another angle to this. Say an individual who looks upon this as an opportunity to find power, the power over someone else.
Yes, that happens. Shamanism is power. But that's because shamanism is knowledge. And anything that is based on knowledge has power. Now, you've heard it said many times, I'm sure, and as many of your listeners have heard, that they say things like, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I've always said that that's absolutely ridiculous, because if that were true, then, of course, God or the creator would have to be the most corrupt of all things. And that's not true. Power does not corrupt absolutely. It is only so when the person who is wielding it is corrupt. Because it's knowledge, those who have knowledge will automatically have power. This doesn't necessarily mean that they know how to wield that power. We have a saying that says, I'm sure some of your listeners may have heard it before, too. They say, those whom the gods would destroy they first make mad with power. The gods do not take power away from you. They enhance it. The best way to get rid of somebody is just to give them more power. They just hang themselves 100% of the time because they don't know how to wield it. They didn't develop character, the ethical position, or the spiritual maturity to wield it. So it is very common that people will go down this line because they want, and a lot of them are on that path because they want a sense of power. And shamanism will provide anyone who follows it with power, some degree of power, personal power, emotional, mental, or physical power for certain. But if you're on the path and you're going down the path the right way, you will always check it. You will always check your own power 100% of the time, because you know that it will ask you for more and it will demand of you more. And the more that it demands of you, the less of you there is. And that's not why you started the journey. And I know many people that started the shamanic path to grow and develop, and now they don't have any freedom. They don't have any freedom at all. They're always dealing with other people's sickness, and they're always dealing with all kinds of issues and psychological, emotional, and psychic attacks and all this sort of nonsense. And that's the reason they left that world in the first place. They wanted a path that was true, that had some honesty, some reality to it. And now they're, because of their desire for that power, they've become slaves to it. Think of some of these gurus that we've seen in the last 500 years, right? Like Sai Baba. There's a charlatan for you right there. He was a bad magician even. He only knew how to do two magic tricks. I hope this doesn't offend your listeners too much, but just a ridiculous example of arrogant stupidity in pursuit for power, to turn yourself into a god. And then you ultimately end up with not being able to come and go as you please. In all the years that Sai Baba was busy doing his guru thing, this guy couldn't just go to the beach and put on a pair of shorts and go in the water. Can you imagine if somebody took a picture? This is Sai Baba. Look at him in his beach shorts, right, on under an umbrella. It just wouldn't look good. So he can't do anything. He can't date. He can't go to a bar. He can't eat. You know, God forbid he should be caught eating something that's not on the holy list of things that thou shalt and shall not do. So it starts off with you get a lot of freedom, you get a lot of power, you get a lot of exaltation, right? Everybody's at your feet, touching your feet and worshiping you. And then it ends with you being a slave to the thing that you created. And that's the tragedy. That power will always bind the person who wants it into the thing itself. You become unfree. So smart shamans, intelligent shamans and shamanesses, they don't go that way. They're not in it for that purpose. The power will come to them automatically because their knowledge is increasing. Their self-knowledge is increasing. But they become more and more humble. They become more and more careful because there's a huge responsibility. And you would be surprised how once you get to a certain level, for example, myself, I don't administer medicine. I refuse to administer any kind of medicine. I educate people. I point them in the right direction. That's not my calling. I find that to be reprehensible in many ways, simply because I think that it's very dangerous. It's a very dangerous thing to do. And if a person has made themselves ill, the journey to becoming well is the most important part. That's what's going to make their healing deep, profound, significant, and true. If you just give them medicine and give them an emotional and psychic experience, that's not going to heal them. That's just going to give them something else to talk about. That's not going to change them. That's no different than Western medicine, where you give somebody something to ease the pain of the symptoms, but you do nothing to arrive at the cure. So shamanism is about arriving at the cure. So you have to let people suffer. You can ease that suffering and you can educate them so that they can avoid it. But you should never take their suffering away, because that is a gift from the creator that will teach them. There isn't a single shaman today. No, there's not a single authentic shaman today of any caliber, of any level, who has not himself or herself suffered. It was their suffering that brought them into this realm. And it was their desire to cease that suffering that led them to the medicines and the right way to think and the right way to live. And that is why they are wise. I'm not for removing those things. I think that there are people that are better suited for that, and that's just not my department. I've seen what happens when people administer medicine. They forget that it's the medicine that does the work. Before long, they start taking claim for it. And when that happens, everything becomes corrupted and twisted. You hear about gurus that are sleeping with their students, and you hear all kinds of corruption. The church is famous for these things. They're famous for it. It's what happens when people arrive at that level and they cannot bear the brunt and the responsibility of that force. That force doesn't care about who you are. It only wants to exist. It needs a good vessel. First stage of shamanic development is to become a clean circuit. so that when that energy runs through you, you're grounded. You're a lightning rod, man. It's going to come in this side. It's going to come out that end. It's going to go to the earth. It's not going to stop at your ego and fill your head up and make you insane, ridiculous.
I would ask one more question for our general listeners, and then we're going to delve a little deeper for our patrons as far as what you're offering when it comes to your teachings that you have developed and I have personally had the privilege of experiencing directly. The last question I am asking is, for those people who are looking to get a better understanding of what we have just discussed in the last hour, are there any references you would recommend? Say, naturally, the self-help section of every bookstore has a plenitude of these things. And sometimes Google is not your friend because you're overwhelmed with information that you cannot distinguish between what is the ideal way of approaching things versus a multitude of other. It's like being in a candy shop and not knowing which flavor you want. So what is your recommendation as far as someone who has just stuck their toe in the water and would like to understand this based on the information you've just shared?
I would say that the first step to do is to take all of the books on the subject of shamanism and burn them so that you have a nice fire to dance around so that you can come to something that is more real, more direct. As I said at the very beginning, shamanism is a ground-up approach. You do not need a teacher to teach you shamanism. Shamanism is taught to you by the world around you. It is in the air that you breathe. It is in the water and the flow of water, what is above the land and what is hidden under the earth. It is in the flights of birds. It is in the nature of how things live and how they survive. Everything you need to know is written on the book on the face of Mother Earth. You need to go nowhere else. You need to become quiet. You need to gather. Make your heart a great basket. And go into the world and collect things and examine them very carefully. Learn from this person and learn from that person. Read a little here, listen a little there. Don't be worried about the snake salesman. You know, test the snake oil yourself. See what the snake oil can tell you. But pay attention to what you are learning. Use your own mind. Use your own thinking. Do not do the Western thing when it comes to shamanism. Abandon the Western mind completely. Completely. Imagine you've just arrived on Earth. And you're learning about it. Figure out who you are, how it works for you. Figure out where your feelings come from, where your thoughts originate from. Figure out what will heal you. Make that the truth. Write it down for yourself. Study it, practice it, test it. All true shamanism follows the very same practice and principles as our modern day science. It is testable, it is repeatable, and it doesn't have a lot of beliefs. Okay, real shamanism doesn't deal with spirits. That's just what we call them to make it clear for the client. A lot of people want to believe in disembodied spirits and so on, but that's not shamanism. It just simply isn't. That's just another religion. That's what the West has done with this natural spirituality, and they converted it into religion. Shamanism is not religion. I repeat, shamanism is not religion. It's spirituality. If you want to believe, pick a church. If you want to experience spirituality, walk the shamanic path. Be yourself. Be present. Pay attention, use your eyes, use your ears, nose, mouth, and hands. Learn as much as you can. Test what you are learning. And if you are defending what you've come to learn, it will be a belief and it will not be a truth. The truth does not need you to defend it. And it will be there after you go, which is why even when you collapse shamanism, it always arises from the ashes 100% of the time. During the fall of the Soviet Union, many shamans from the original path or the original lineage, the Burats, they were murdered. They were killed in horrific ways. They were brought onto choppers, helicopters, and thrown out. They were said, well, we hear that shamans can fly. And they pushed them out of the helicopter and say, well, let's see you fly. And they killed hundreds of thousands of shamans. And they think, well, we've ended it. We've ended this thing. But shamanism is not a religion. It is not a religion. And it will rise up again. It always does. And it's exactly the same as it was 10,000 years ago. It is not different. It can never be different. And it will never be different. If you turn shamanism into a religion, it will rise, it will fall. And from those ashes, real shamanism will spring up again. Okay, so we don't want to walk into the world in belief. So you will discover the shamanic path by observing the world around you. But don't be afraid to learn from people who claim to be shamans or who know a shaman or from a book here or from a book there or from a movie or whatever. Pick up the pieces, gather them together, put them in your basket, give the basket a good shake, grab something and test it. If it stands to your scrutiny and in the power of your intellect and your intelligence with a good ethical heart, it will be true. If you have to defend it, protect it, or explain it, it's crap. It's fertilizer for the truth to spring out from. And it will still be useful because now you will know that that thing is not true. And because now that you know that it is not true, the truth becomes clear to spot. That's the beauty of it. You can't go wrong. It is a Gnostic approach. It is direct, experiential. That's what I would say. But as far as books, yeah, there's all kinds of books. And like I said earlier, you really can't go wrong. I think a more authentic book recently, not that recent, would be, I think Michael Harner wrote a book. He spent some time in the Amazon, and when they made ayahuasca illegal, he no longer had a means to alter consciousness. He turned to drumming, and he discovered that what shamans have all known forever, that ayahuasca is a medicine, it has its place, but that's not the primary method of altering consciousness. Right. What you don't understand about ayahuasca is if you're going to take ayahuasca to do some work, you're in it all day long. You're going to be in it for the next 12 hours. If you've got 12 hours to burn, that's great. A shaman would prefer to grab his drum or her drum or maybe do some ecstatic dance for 15 minutes, get the alteration that they need, get the insight, come back to center, get their heads clear, and then know what direction they're going. And you can do that in 15 minutes, not ruin the rest of your day. Right. So there's no recovery. It's much quicker. But there's different methods for different people, different medicines for different ailments. And it's not a one wonder drug that can do everything for everyone. It's not a single principle that works for everybody. Shamanism will have its many platforms. This is why the emblem of shamanism is a tree. And the tree is normally shown with seven branches or nine. And it's a tree that shows these different levels. So some shamans will always grasp the low hanging fruit, while other shamans will go towards the top of the tree. And it's only at the top of the tree that you can see all of the trees that are in the forest. That's where the canopy opens into the true light. And so each person has to decide where they want to be on that tree, how high up they want to go. So if you're the shaman that wants to do workshops on weekends, there's nothing wrong with that. Make a little bit of money for yourself, that's fine. Hopefully you're authentic. But if you just practice that long enough, you will be made authentic because your clients are going to call you out. And you will be exposed. I promise you, you're not getting away with anything. But if you're already authentic and you're doing that work, the practice of doing that work will make you better because it is a practice. It is not a belief. You can't go into the shop every day, pretend to be a carpenter, work with wood and not come out the other end an actual carpenter. It's just going to happen. It's going to happen because it's a practice. Yeah, I wouldn't recommend or say that anything in particular, but if you're looking for a book that can get you kind of started that I think is relatively safe, Michael Harner has some good words to say. But again, the best thing to do is to dump the Western mind. Don't believe in lineages. That's just nonsense. Shamans don't have lineages. We have teachers that we honor and respect because we've learned from them, but that's a Western thing, lineage. Think about it, how silly it is. Like, who authorized you to be a shaman? Well, you know, my teacher. Well, who authorized them? Well, their teacher. Well, who authorized them? Somebody made it up. Somebody made the authorization of lineage. They made that up too. Who authorized you to be a mother? Let me see your papers. Prove to me that you've earned that right. You don't have to do that. The virtue of being a mother is your credentials. It's in the practice of who you are. Whether you're a good mother or not isn't up to you to decide. Your children are the ones that tell you. Your kids will show you that you're a good mother. You don't need a piece of paper that says you are. It's direct. It comes from the experience. And that's the beauty of shamanism. It will always be uncontaminated. Even if you turn it into a religion, it will not stand. It will come down under the weight of its own arrogance, collapsing into the ground, burning into a pile of ash. From those ashes, true shamanism will spring up again.
And on that perfect note, we will end this component of this extraordinary conversation. We'll take our patrons on a little walk towards that tree you were describing. The last thing I would ask is, how would people be able to get in touch with you should they want to take the opportunity to investigate this further as far as the classes that you're offering?
Well, I offer a class that kind of lays down some foundations. You know, it's not about shamanism, but it does lay down the foundations and principles necessary for somebody who wants to pursue that. But it doesn't really matter if you're a religious person or not. They're just principles that are easily provable, easily demonstrable, and insightful. So one way they can get in contact, of course, is that if they show some interest and they want to reach out to you, you can kind of put their names forward. And if there's enough interest, then maybe we can do something to share more about that.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
And it's only simply because I tend to be a rather private person. As I said to you earlier, shamans like the charlatans and the fools because it keeps the path to your door free from noise so that you can tend to the people that actually need to see you. A very different approach.
And that's proof positive that you're authentic right there. So
I should think so. All right. Thank you very much, Yvonne. Thank you for having us here. Lots of love to all of you out there who are listening. I wish you the very best. And those of you that are on that path, don't give up. Don't quit. Trust your spirit, trust your insight, and really trust what you were given from the very beginning, which is a good mind, a good heart, and a good set of senses to use, to observe, and to learn from.
If you found this information valuable, please consider sponsoring our channel by way of patreon.com/godboxcafe and join the rest of our patrons to hear the continuation of this conversation and many other bonus episodes.